Okay, shall we begin? Let's review for a moment, very quickly, where we are. We spent some time talking about what I've called Cartesian skepticism, what its characteristic form is, how it takes a certain sort of general shape, how it appears across a number of areas of philosophy, how they're different, as I put it, variants of that variety of skepticism. Then we've done the same thing for Kantian skepticism. That is, we've just started again, looked at problems that come up in certain areas of philosophy. Notice a problem of another kind of shape. So far what we've been doing is, as it were, merely describing things that happen in philosophy, things that other philosophers have said, things that you can go out and find. So far not much of a philosophical claim has been made, other than descriptions. If the descriptions are wrong, if I've misdescribed a certain problem, or a certain problem doesn't come up, or hardly anyone talks about it, that seems a problem. But otherwise, there's just, as it were, a range of phenomena. Then what we did was start to try to characterize these things in somewhat more detail. And I did this by giving you a set of features. And one thing that came out extremely nicely in the exchange, anticipated things I wanted to say, but I want to use it since it happened, in the exchange at the end of class between Paul and myself about Scheffler and Goodman, and it led me to make some remarks about Kripke. One of the things we saw about these lists of features that you got two handouts ago, that would have been handout three, I suppose, is that these lists of features don't necessarily exclude each other within a single philosopher's corpus. You can have a philosopher working on something that has a Kantian shape and then trying to immediately answer a Cartesian question. So that raises the question about what's happening. I suggest in a piece that I asked you to read for the last few classes that we might think of these two varieties of skepticism. Varieties is intentionally a weasel word. Now we're trying to figure out what varieties might mean. I introduce another weasel word, slightly more specific one, which we'll break down further. But we might think of these as genres of skepticism. And the reason to speak of a genre here is because I take it a genre as something that's characterized by features, but none of the features are necessary or sufficient. If you think about what makes something a Western, well, try it. There's lots of things you could name. If something takes place in the West, and it has horses, and it's good and evil, and there's a frontier, and they're setting up a civilization, and there's a bartender, and there's a sheriff, and I go on, I list enough of these features, it's going to be a Western. But there isn't any one of these features that makes a movie a Western. You can have somebody who's a sheriff in it. And you can take anyone out. And in fact, a lot of what Western's about is what happens when the sheriff rounds up all the guns. Or whatever. That is, you remove a feature and see what the implications of it are for the other features. Another feature about genres, if I go and define another genre, say the romantic comedy or something, there isn't anything in principle that excludes the possibility of a movie that's both a Western and a romantic comedy. When you do try to cross genres, what you get is often a mess, aesthetically speaking. And that's an interesting fact, which we could take up in a different kind of class. But there isn't, as it were, a logical contradiction between mixing features. So what articulates a genre are certain kinds of features. The features do have a certain kind of coherence, much more than you might think. It's not an accident that, you know, Westerns take place on the edge of civilization. And if you want to relocate a Western, you have to relocate it to a certain kind of a place in space and time in order to get, you know, the same sort of good and evil, etc. The same sort of incipient or fragile, as it were, conditions of civilization, both asserting themselves and threatening other to collapse, and so on. Similarly, with the features I gave you for these two kinds of skepticism, one of the things I tried to bring out as we went through them is that they're internally related. As we clearly articulated, one of the features that led to others. But what you certainly can get in a particular author's writings is an apparent cohabitation on the surface of these features. So one thing we're going to ask is philosophically, what does that mean if that happens? That's the kind of question that's going to come up for us. It started to come up last class. I just wanted to flag it since it started to come up last class. It's an important issue. But I do want to put it aside for a couple more classes, and then we'll really look at that issue carefully. What I want to do today is look a little more carefully at Kantian skepticism, using the example of C.I. Lewis. And here's the reason I want to do what I'm doing today. I think Cartesian skepticism, and I think this itself is an important fact about it, which we'll bear thinking later on. I think Cartesian skepticism is, as it were, much more immediately gripping. What do I mean by immediately gripping? Well, one thing I mean is it happened earlier in the history of philosophy for each area of philosophy. I think that's not an accident. Another thing you might mean by immediately gripping, and I think this is just true, is try teaching undergraduates. You can get undergraduates gripped very quickly, at least puzzled, you know, perplexed, in some sort of feeling of paradoxicality about a Cartesian variant of each of those problems. Try the other minds thing. It's not that you can't get them interested in Kantian skepticism in the same area, but it takes more work. And in particular, the more philosophy classes somebody's had, the easier it is to get them interested in the Kantian variant of skepticism. That is, Kantian skepticism itself, a feeling, a sensitivity for a problematic of that shape, itself depends upon a certain kind of sophistication, philosophical. It depends upon having worried about philosophical issues a certain amount. Why that should be, again, is a question I'd like to take up. But so what I want to do today with C.I. Lewis in the context of philosophy of perception is help us see from within why a particular variant, important variant, of Kantian skepticism can be gripping. I don't want to just do what I've done so far, which is describe the Cartesian case, describe the Kantian case, sound it's different, but actually make you feel the grippingness of it. And in particular, what I want you to do is feel how a certain variant of Kantian skepticism can be gripping. What I mostly showed you last class was, here's Price, here's Lewis. Price is in a Cartesian problematic, as I put it. He's trying to answer a Cartesian skeptic. Lewis is in a Kantian problematic. But what we haven't really talked about yet was what it would mean if things from inside Lewis's problematic seem to start to fall apart. That is, trying to answer a question that looks like a question he's got to be able to answer also doesn't seem to be answerable. So that a genuine threat of Kantian skepticism, whatever that would be, starts to loom. So it actually seems like, you know, not just something a philosopher invented in order to have someone to talk to, but something that starts to threat in the form that Kantian skepticism threats. As I've said before, what that looks like is not something that takes the form of a doubt. It has a different shape. And part of what I want to do is see more clearly what that shape is by looking more detail at this case. Now, I could have chosen different cases. I think in some ways the easy way out here would have been to do it in a case of philosophy of language, because that's the version of Kantian skepticism in contemporary philosophy that people actually are most preoccupied and find most gripping. But I'd like to do it in philosophy of perception, because I think that's actually historically in this century the one that initially exercised people more. And it's not an accident. If you go back and read all kinds of people in the late 19th and early 20th century. And I'll try to say a bit about how what we're looking at today is the background of a great deal of contemporary, at least Anglophone, philosophy. And secondly, because I think it makes a nice pair with the form of Cartesian skepticism we've talked about the most in philosophy of perception, and that is most readily available to you, probably. Also, I think it's easier to model the other versions of Kantian skepticism off of this as the paradigm example. So, trying to get Kantian skepticism to be gripping. So, let's see what it's like to be C.I. Lewis and get into trouble. Maybe one more preliminary note. Sorry for so many preliminaries. One other thing that's come up a couple of times in the class, which is an excellent question, which I'm also going to defer, really, for only one more class now, is the question of how are Cartesian and Kantian skepticism related? We're just treating these as two phenomena. Here's a way you can pick up a problem. It starts to have this shape. Here, you can pick up the problem in a different way. It has a different shape. One of the things we saw last time is a lot of the same philosophical vocabulary. I wrote a lot of words on the board last time. Can even start to have a different kind of content. Words like object, consciousness, given, epistemic, directly present to, and so forth. All of that vocabulary starts to function in a different register. But we haven't said anything about, well, how do you get from the one to another? Is this a coincidence? We'll start to take that question up next class. What I'm going to try to do today is just motivate Lewis's problem, ab initio, as if Kantian skepticism just started in a philosophical vacuum, just as a worry about knowledge, experience, and so forth, as Cartesian skepticism does. That's how Lewis himself presents in his book to some extent. But I will just add a footnote here and say, I think that's actually extremely misleading, what I'm doing. I do think it's not an accident that this kind of skepticism comes on the background of a prior problem. But for the purposes of simplification, I'll just try to motivate it as if it were self-standing problematic today. Okay. So, here's a way of doing it. We're thinking about knowledge. We're Lewis. And we're looking at previous philosophy. We're realizing that things didn't go that well. The empiricists get into one kind of hopeless problem, he thinks. The rationalists get into another kind of hopeless problem. We talked about this last class. He, following Kant, doing something he takes to be following Kant, as I showed you, very many people do, taking themselves to be following Kant, while having a very different take on how to follow Kant in this respect, say, the empiricists and the rationalists have made a common mistake. The way we saw Lewis put this last week, this is from page 25 of his book, is that their common error rests on a certain kind of impossible separation. They both want to separate a certain kind of contribution of the passive faculty of cognition, the sense, what it is to take things in sentiently, faculty of sensibility is not exercises consistent intuitions, immediate representations. They want to separate that from the active faculty, the understanding, that has to then do something, work it out, contribute something to what comes in before it can be knowledge. In particular, introduce conditions of correctness and incorrectness so that things can be such that what we think about how things are could be wrong. For them to be such that they could be wrong, there have to be normative conditions involved in the application of the thought. That involves a thought that's structured a certain way. It has to have the form of, if you will, X is phi, minimally. This is red. Such that things could be such that if things aren't red, I know that I've thought something false. So we already have Lewis developing a problem now in a Kantian form. He's not worried about given the things seem a certain kind of way. How can I know they're really that way? But how could I even have an experience that has the form, this is right, X is phi, even if it's false? What does it take for experience to have that form? And one of the things he says it takes, Kantians will say it takes, is how he puts it, is concepts. And concepts have boundaries, and we could have other concepts. One of the things we do is refine our concepts. So our concepts are something we bring to experience. That's part of what to say. They belong to an active faculty of cognition. And the question is, how are these related? And the generically Kantian claim, as I put it last time, was that without both of these conditions, we can't have knowledge. Each is necessary, neither is sufficient. And then I showed you how there are very many different ways to understand that generically Kantian claim. A different way to put that claim is to say that we need both of these faculties, and now the difficult thing to understand is their cooperation. And what's happened in both empiricism and rationalism is, instead of having a story about their cooperation, we've had a story in which one is the dog and the other is the tail. In empiricism, the dog, as it were, the thing that really, you know, provides most of the force, the thing that gives us things that are incipiently or initially states of knowledge or awareness, is just what comes in. Those are already impressions. Those are already of things. From a Kantian point of view, if you've got impressions of things, you've got the game. For Descartes, A thinking being enjoys ideas, res cogitans, has thoughts. Where did those come from? That's already been, we've already helped ourselves to that on the rationalist and empiricist sides, respectively. The empiricist then sees the ideas as in various ways being processed by the intellect. It sifts them and arranges them by principles of association. They get vaguer, become ideas, but therefore more general. But the crucial move's been made. The rationalist thinks the crucial case of knowledge comes with ideas we have for free. And then we need to hook those up with something outside. We need a circuit to the external world. But that circuit simply allows us to then come up with more ideas. But the capacity to have ideas that are substantively about something, that's something a non-sentient being should enjoy. So an empiricist thinks that intellection is not a condition on having an impression of something. And a rationalist thinks that our sensory capacities, empirical receptivity to the world, is not a condition on having a thought about something. Both kinds of philosophers take us to have representations that are, in the sense that a Kantian's worried about, vulnerable to how things are, simply through the operation of one of those faculties. And then they bring the other one to tell their whole story. Lewis thinks, no, you can't even have that which each side is presupposing without already having a cooperation. That's what we saw him arguing, particularly on the empiricist side, as they tried to bring out, contrasting him with Schlick. But now, the question is, how do you tell the story without getting into trouble? What we saw when we looked at Lewis in more detail, Lewis being a nice person to look at, because I think he is very acute, he is very sensitive to the problems, is it's very hard to tell this problem without falling into trouble, back into one of those two forms of trouble. So, Lewis wants to say, well, we can't have what the empiricists have. We can't have contentful impressions for free. So, what's the role of the senses? Well, if the senses just causally impinge on us, and that causes us to have some ideas or other, but all rational constraint just comes at the level of concepts. If what made my view of the world true is that it fit with all the other things I believe, and that's all it had to do, all my beliefs had to do is fit with my other beliefs, then Lewis worries, quotation 2, that we don't really have a story of the given, of empirical data. There's stuff that comes in that just causes stuff to happen. The empiricists have somehow turned these things that cause into things that give us content for free. He sees that's too much. But if we take that away and make it mere sensations that cause us, there be no, as it were, content given to the mind, what he calls here datum given to the mind. Then knowledge must be contentless and arbitrary. There would be nothing which it must be true to. So our frame of beliefs has to be answerable to something outside of it. So I'm going to draw a picture. I didn't draw pictures when I was doing the Cartesian side of things, but I hope it's clear I could have. These pictures matter. I think these pictures themselves are, in a way, part of what's controlling each of these problematics. In the Cartesian shape, I was always in my stories about Cartesian problems, I was always insinuating a picture. I was saying things like, well, if I'm dreaming, then things seem to me exactly as they do now. So on the inside, it's very hard not to say a word like that. On the inside, so here's the mind. And on the inside, I'm having my in front of a classroom experience. But on the outside, there's the world. And then how can I know from the inside that this relation between what's happening inside and what happens the outside really matches? It looks like I need a view from here. Descartes actually explicitly introduces somebody who has a view from there. God. Well, the problem is, once we get rid of him, things start getting a bit hairy. How do we bootstrap ourselves out there? But so is it with the idea of inside and outside, with the idea of something like a veil or a screen, with the idea of something that happens beneath or behind, is a picture. Similarly, here's Kato. How do I know he's in pain? The way that Cartesian problem goes also immediately involves a parallel picture with mind and world reversed. But the picture is, the pain is in the inside. It's part of Cartesian philosophy to always think that thoughts, experiences, pains, they are in some sense literally here. That's where they are. It's part of what makes materialism then such an attractive view. Because it keeps that part of the picture, but then it tries to make it seem unmysterious. Actually try to look for it. Once you start actually trying to look for in the brain the thought that blah, 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 all sorts of problems start to come up about what you think you're looking for, what your shape would be. Is the true thought and the false thought two different things you're looking for? And so forth. That's just the beginning of the problem. Once you start noticing is, you know, that there's all kinds of different ways to express a thought in different notation. You don't need negation as a connective and so forth. And you start realizing it's only by fetishizing a particular form of expression of thought that you even think you have something to look for in that sense. Thoughts themselves are only articulated in relation to other thoughts. So there's a picture, again, of literally inside and so on. Cartesian pictures. But now what I want you to do is get a sense of cosmic pictures. So here, the picture is, we have the realm of something like, now it's not the mind. It's not the right way to put it. If we think of the mind as something like a container or a self-standing realm, as the Cartesian is inclined to, or if we're doing say the second variant of contingent skepticism with the body is there thought of the container. It's in exactly the same state outwardly. It's psychologically neutral regardless of what's going on the inside. Here, we want to draw a picture. We're going to have to write something like the conceptual. It's a much more abstract picture. The conceptual. This includes things like the thought that there is an elephant in this room. That's a conceptual representation of something that appears. Something's happening. But it's a thought I can think about this, which is conceptually articulated. It involves things like my having mastered the concept of elephant. Last time we talked a lot about the concepts fountain pen and cell phone. But same point, those have to be acquired to think true or false thoughts in which they are ingredient. So, we think of this as the conceptual, and then there is the given, something that has to be outside of this. And what we want to understand is this interface. What the empiricists did is tell a story in which the shape of our concepts come from the given. Something impresses itself on me. I have an impression of one cat, an impression of another cat. And Locke says, from these I abstract the general idea of cat. So the shape of the concept really just comes from the impressions themselves. They dictate the shape of the concept. It starts looking like you ought to be able to draw a picture of a general cat. Try doing it sometime. My general lecture, in my public lecture in a couple of weeks, I'll actually give a lecture in which we talk about Gottlieb, which he actually tried to give us photographic representations of general ideas. He's taking his empiricist very seriously. One of the nice things is you really see how the idea falls apart when you try to take it that literally. As it gets more general, there's also questions. If it's a picture, you know, I give you a kind of nice schematic picture, and then I ask you, is it a picture of my cat or cats? Or Siamese's? Or, is it a picture of the concept members of the cat family, which includes not only domestic cats, but lions, tigers, and panthers? As the picture gets more schematic, what would it mean for it to be a picture of one of those things rather than another? And once we start thinking much more abstract, general ideas, like weighing over 100 pounds. What would it be like to cast that in terms of a picture? the empiricist is literally, it goes this way. This is a problematic that's in previous philosophy, but it's now being thematized by the Kantians, that the given imposes the shape of the concepts. That gets into all kinds of problems. Problems that come up in contemporary philosophy under the myth of the given, as a species of the myth of the given. That some kind of sensory contact with the world could itself give you something that introduces the kind of normative constraint that a concept involves with a particular sphere of application, certain boundaries, certain things fall under, certain things that determine contact. It's worth noticing that that's what you think the myth of the given is. That's what many people say it is. If you read Brandom's study guide to Sellers, he'll tell you that's what the myth of the given is. Then we already saw last class that Lewis is a critic of the myth of the given. That is, we saw lots of quotations where Lewis was saying, the given cannot deliver that. We must have concepts too. We don't have any structure. So if the given were simply exhausted by that particular species of the myth, Lewis would go down in history as one of its critics. Actually, Lewis is a central target of Sellers in that book. So that means, and we've seen that he also wants to defend something he calls the given. So that means there's other guises of the myth. Michael.
Yeah, sorry, I have
several
questions, but only one.
Okay, but, unbelievable. Okay.
This argument is the same, like the argument more or less of the themselves, I guess. The critic of this myth of the given, of that something comes from the... From
what I just tried to say, let me just repeat what I said is, if we thought Sellers' argument reduced to what I just said, that would be right. Many people think that of Sellers. And Sellers' thought wouldn't be new at all. But what I just tried to say is, that can't be right about Sellers.
Yeah.
Because then Sellers would have no criticism of Lewis. So what I've just said is that a standard reading of Sellers is just a footnote, completely misses Sellers' point. That's what I just tried to say.
Yeah. Okay.
So I haven't said anything, actually, about what Sellers is actually criticizing.
Yeah. I'm just
in any deeper interesting. It's only the first few pages of Sellers.
Very good question now. This is... To my point of view, this is only trying to re-establish or to reinforce the whole Kantian project, you know. But where is there the new thing in it? I can't see it actually.
Well, if that's all. First of all, I think Sellers isn't trying to do something here. He's trying to. Well, he takes himself to be explaining Kant.
He's like Hegel. That's my impression.
But I think he thinks. Well, it's a question about the relationship between Kant and Hegel. Hegel was trying to build on Kant. But he would certainly agree that this much is basic to the argument of the transinduction, or the first chapter of the phenomenology.
It's
the first chapter of the phenomenology, too. It's about this in the beginning of Hegel. How can a this have determinate content? So it's in both of them. This much is in both of them. Whatever their differences are, Hegel learned this much from Kant. So I don't think he would be bothered by that question at all. He would just say, you got to read further in Kant and in Hegel and in me to get the differences.
Okay.
This is just very elementary. And as we've seen, this bit of elementary material is already in Lewis. He's learned this much from him too. But then, so the given can't do this by itself. Converse worry, though, if we draw the arrow this way. So that was a story in which we say, this structure comes from here. There's some sort of impingement. And the shape of what comes in, you could draw little shapes if you want. Make little shapes over here if you want to make your picture very pictorial. Think about philosophical pictures. Is if you fill them in too much, they get hard to draw. But that doesn't mean that they don't control your thinking in an inchoate form. It's one reason it's good to literalize the picture, to realize, what am I thinking if I try to fill this in? What is this line I'm drawing in thought? The other way to go, what Lewis thinks is a misreading of the idealists in the quotations we looked at last time, but the way many people, he thinks, have dismissed the idealists by misreading them, is to say, there is no constraint from the given. The given here means something that actually plays a role in knowledge, that offers constraint from, shall we say, the outside. That's part of this picture I'm trying to show you is working here, simply at some level. So, yeah, sure, something impinges on our senses. But constraint all comes from this side. We have concepts. Depending upon the concepts we have, if I teach you the concept red rather than a language which has the concept mauve, vermilion, and scarlet but doesn't happen to have a word for a color like red, That's unlikely since it's a primary color, so we should probably change that example slightly. but you can see how that would go. I sort of like, here's two German words, Stuhl und Sessel. Here's an English word, chair. There is no English word that divides quite like this. It's not obvious there's any German word that divides quite like this. We could introduce some word like Sitz, but that would actually be too inclusive. It would go beyond just these things to include benches and appropriately shaped stones and all kinds of things. So we can count, and if we ask how many, we'll get different answers depending on which concepts we have. So we bring, so on this view, we have some concepts. We bring another example I like very much is the French, rive and fleuve. In English, we have a river. Creates a similar kind of problem. We don't have this distinction. They don't obviously have a word that has quite this generality. So, if you have this kind of view, how you carve up the given is simply a function of your concepts. But this is where Lewis now worries. I understand the problem with the empiricists, but if you thought that there was no given that introduced constraint, constraint only came from the concepts, what would make these the right concepts rather than those the right concepts is just how they fit with the rest of your concepts. And there's lots of structures of concepts you can articulate. There's going to be something else that selects between them, which comes from, here's the picture, now, outside. But notice, just as we saw last time, that words like directly present to, immediately in touch with, the last class I was trying to show you, they function differently in a Cartesian or Kantian register. This language too, which will come up in both cases of inside, outside, functions differently in a Cartesian Kantian register. Actually, the picture has been changed. And you can easily miss this and see philosophers as directly addressing the same issue when they're not. Outside here means outside the realm of the conceptual. Something that passively impinges, but has not been authored by us. Inside means within the realm of conception, something that has a kind of shape because it is in some sense a spontaneous human creation, something we brought to it. Be it a good way to sort or not, be it locally something that says something true or not. Just that last clause is just to bring out the difference from the Cartesian problem. So, what Lewis is saying in quotation two is the arrow can't go this way either. That's the bad reading ideals. And he thinks, he wrote his PhD dissertation on Fichte, after all. He thinks that's a bad, that's not what the great Fichte and Kant and Hegel thought. That's just a bad way to read the ideals. They're not denying there is such a thing as the given. All they're denying is that the given without concepts, in good Kantian fashion, could be anything more than blind. So, here's our problem. We need somehow constraint coming in both directions. And that's where the pit, it gets hard to fill things in. This is what I said, where the problem is now to tell a story about the character of the cooperation that doesn't run into trouble. But the assumption that Lewis keeps, let me bring out this assumption, comes out in your first quotation, is that the pure concepts and the content of the given are mutually independent of one another. That is, to put it in McDowell's language, what constrains the conceptual must lie outside the boundary of the conceptual. He thinks, if you will, in this picture, if I made this circle larger, I would fall into vicious idealism. Virtuous idealism is just denying the given. Virtuous idealism is denying that the given alone suffices. Vicious idealism is to deny the given. Virtuous empiricism, so Lewis is trying to be both an empiricist and an idealist. He's very explicit about this. And in contemporary philosophy, McDowell's another example of someone who's trying to do this. People find this confusing. I think there's a sense in which this is already true of Kant. But his vocabulary didn't quite work that way. The great truth in empiricism Lewis thinks, and Kant, I think he thinks he's with Kant, is that the given experience, what comes in must be, as McDowell puts it, some sort of tribunal. That's the virtuous thought of empiricism. Vicious empiricism, again, is to think this suffices. The vicious view in each case involves the common assumption of what we saw was the impossible separation. Last class. So the question is, how to reconcile the virtuous assumption in each without falling into the vicious, virgin reach? How do we do that? And the picture works. The crucial assumption here, which goes with the inside-outside language, is that this must constrain from the outside somehow. That's what he means by saying this and that do not limit one another. We must have genuine normativity. That means it's got to be constructed. That can't get that for free. You have a magical view if you think normative structure can just pop out of it. That's the kind of mistake the empiricists make. But you have an empty. This kind of structure is always blind. But there has to be constraint from the outside in our concepts. This kind of structure by itself, without any guidance from without, to take the picture literally again, makes this empty, these concepts empty. That's his way of understanding the real force of the dictum about emptiness and blindness, respectively, for concepts and intuitions if we don't have the right kind of cooperation. But now he's trying to understand how to flesh this out. And I showed you that he's critical of different ways of understanding that Kantian dictum. He thinks that these are too independent. You have the impossible separation. If you just say, both are necessary, neither sufficient. But you understand that, so you make the independence too great. You have the impossible separation. But if you make it too intimate, if you go Kassirer's way, in the quotation we looked at last time, in his reading of Kant, and you're too holistic, and you don't have it be the case that neither limits each other, then you fall into the problem of quotation two, he thinks. So, how are we going to avoid this? And that's what we saw him trying to do. He's struggling to do that. What he wants to do is, here's a way of putting it in terms of the picture. He wants to get the realm of the conceptual and the realm of the given close enough. It says that he's trying to move these together close enough that this can somehow impinge on or guide that. It doesn't just, as it were, bounce off it causally, but introduces some normative constraint. He's trying to interpolate something here that can allow a relation of guidance from the outside. But if he gets it too close, then it looks like he has the problem of quotation too. It's just the dog of the concepts waving the tail of what we take ourselves to experience. It's just a function of the way in which, as Kant puts it in the Transcendental, we cannot help but think. And if we just think that way because we have those concepts and we can't help but think them, then Kant says, that is to give the skeptic what he most desires. That problem is no problem with Kantian skepticism. If we wind up with the view that we now cannot see our experience as genuinely having empirical content, as being the kind of thing that could be true or false, as involving any kind of constraint, as either being merely blind or merely empty. The horns of that dilemma is what the shape of Kantian skepticism is. So Lewis thinks that can't be right. What you always think if you're a Kantian, of course that can't be right. There's no question of the Kantian skeptic being right in a sense. One sentence, I'll just finish this sentence. The only example I know of somebody who's a sort of a figure for a kind of Kantian skeptic so far in philosophy, a full-blown one, Hume is a sort of half-blown one, and it's easier to think you can sustain the position if it's only half-blown. The only full-blown one I know is, the guy we might call Kripkenstein. It's not an accident. It's not Kripke's position. And take it from me, it's not Wittgenstein's position. It's this position that Kripke's attributed to Wittgenstein, but he's not sure if it really is his, but he'll... So the only example of someone who's actually pushing as a conclusion a Kantian skeptical line within some area of philosophy is someone that hasn't existed It's not an accident, I think. That doesn't make it any less pressing for all that. Sorry, I just want to finish that.
I just wanted to explain more about that phrase, the relation of guidance.
Yes, okay, good. Well, I'll put it more in Lewis's way. I mean, there's many ways to put this. I mean, a general way to put it, you know, with respect to the philosophy of language case we had before, is if there's a mere mark, there's a shape of a sign or a word, what is it that makes this way of using it correct rather than that way? That's a way we already talked about in the philosophy of language context. But in the context of philosophy of perception, the way it comes up for Lewis is something impinges on me. I have an experience. I look here. It might be easier just to do this with simple concepts, for, like colors for a moment, instead of something complicated like cell phone and fountain pen. I wish this was a more uniform color. Excuse me, whoever this might be. I can only see this part of the hat. Here I want to use the concept silver. Here I want to use the concept green. I want to say, that is silver. That is green. I also want to say, assuming the lighting's fine, my eyesight's fine, all that stuff, which we can start worrying about in a while, and get back into a Cartesian problem, I'm right. This is silver. That is green. And now Lewis's problem is, in virtue of what? There must be something that I'm taking in that licenses the application, the concept silver here. And license the application of the concept green. There has to be something coming in that makes this concept the right one to use here, that concept the right one to use there. And he wants to say, that itself won't constrain the conceptual unless it's unbounded, unless it's outside the conceptual, unless it itself is dictating which concepts to use. It wouldn't ground my use of concepts unless it was outside my use of concepts. But he's also very acute. He realizes all of the problems with classical empiricism that start to become clear in Kant and Hegel and so forth. So he realizes a particular thing, an object in the world, can be classified a thousand ways. This can be classified as round, silver, you know, larger than a tomato in a million other ways, including like concepts I don't have. A thing can't make that right. It has to be something more than a thing. It has to be there has to be something that has not the structure of a particular, but something that has some structure of generality, such that this is a case of silver. This and this and this and this is silver. I have to be putting this together with other things for this to be silver. You know, a single thing in itself can be brought under any concept or not, if the concept only has a single instance. In a sense, I mean, something that only one thing falls under, you can't call anything else that, is, if you will, a proper name, not a concept. And learning somebody's name is learning something that's been stipulated, learning something that's true or false. So he realizes there has to have some generality. If this is going to constrain that, it has to have some character of generality. This is already a problem in the empiricists. They want impressions to be atoms, sensory atoms, particular items, that then have a certain kind of bearing that no particular can have. So he realizes there has to be generality here, and that's why he draws his distinction, which we will come to in a moment. Again, we talked about this briefly last time, between a quail and a concept. There has to be something that comes from the level of the senses, such that when I see one of these that has this quality, and I see another one of these that has this quality, there's a problem here, right? I can't name the quality and say silver. Lewis will immediately point out, as he does in your reading, that's already to employ the concept silver. We're trying to get something more basic. And he thinks in principle, undescribable. the reasons we'll get into. Any of you have read Wittgenstein's private language argument will realize Lewis is heading right into the teeth of it. But I'm trying to give you some sense of why there's a deep reason people head into the teeth of it. And that it has a Kantian structural motivation. The deep version of the private language argument is directed at a certain kind of Kantian skeptical problem. It tends to be construed as if the worry was simply a certain kind of Cartesian. So there's got to be some way to recognize this as the same again. There's something which, in employing my senses, I see this, and I look at employing my senses, and in some sense I can see this as the same as that. I can see they're qualitatively the same. If I didn't have that ability to look at green and look at some other green, look out the window at some grass, there wasn't some recognitional capacity to see those as qualitatively alike that was grounded in senses. He thinks there wouldn't be anything that was really anchoring our use of the concept when we employed the concept and said green and shine. Then we would just be, this would be disconnected from that. It would, to employ a metaphor of McDowell's, we would just be frictionlessly spinning in, to add a word, a conceptual void without any resistance from something outside. To employ another metaphor, the world itself would have no voice, no normative voice, would offer no guidance in how we employ our concepts. So, that's what I meant. Let's attempt to be slightly more precise, Dixon, about what I meant when I said there has to be guidance coming from the given. I think we should take a break, come back in 10 minutes, and then I'll try to show you how, if this falls apart, we have a content structure.